Hello and welcome to The Menu, Monocle Radio's food and drink programme. I'm your host, Chiara Rimella. Coming up, we flick through a cookbook dedicated to the art of making the perfect egg.
There is few countries in the world that don't have eggs as a national dish. There are lots of examples of that. But also, you cook an egg and you can reach into your larder or your cupboard and embellish it in thousands of ways.
Also on the programme, we venture to Athens to pick some fragrant Mediterranean herbs.
You have places which are completely different in terms of sun exposure, the water, the vegetation, the wind that they get. And these are the elements that give to crops their character.
Plus, we head to Tallinn to meet the Noma-trained chef who switched fine dining for burgers. All that here on The Menu on Monocle Radio. Everyone thinks they know how to fry an egg, but do they really know how to make a good one? Eggs are a staple that have a place on almost every table around the world. If you're after a quick and easy meal, you need only reach for the cardboard box in the fridge. But beside the classic brunch recipes that have consecrated their place alongside avocado and bacon, there is room to get more creative with this building block of cuisine. Ed Smith is a food writer with a particular fondness for this ingredient, which is why he has dedicated his entire book, Good Eggs, to 100 recipes that put this often unsung hero centre stage. Whether you prefer them scrambled, boiled, poached or fried, these recipes will egg you on to get experimental over breakfast. Ed Smith joined me in the studio to reveal his tricks to achieve the perfect yolk and talk to me about why this ingredient has such a sunny disposition.
There are a few things that can make me smile, but that make me immediately smile more than when you cut into a, say, a poached or a hard-boiled egg yolk and it spills out. It's like molten sunshine, and that sounds, it's horribly cliche, but it's kind of true. And there's something quite childlike about that as well. You know, the dippy egg, when you dip a bit of toast in, it takes you, even if it wasn't part of your childhood, straight to being a child in a good way. They're also really easy to embellish, infinite variety. So, I mean, I could go on.
Well, we're here to do just that. But I think it's interesting because the book is a colourful, wonderful, sunshine in a book type of book. And I find it interesting that there are some recipes that are admittedly very, very simple.
Yeah.
And some others that get a bit more involved.
Yeah.
But I suppose, what was your thinking when you were choosing the recipes to put in?
Sure.
Was there any point at which you were like, can I actually have like a fried egg sandwich with red and brown sauce
in
this?
So it starts with that recipe, yeah. So I guess fundamentally it is a book of eggs, and it's eggs as the centrepiece. Eggs as the reason you're cooking the meal, rather than eggs as an ingredient, so it's not custards and ice creams. And as a result, I started thinking about recipes for this meal. It was a mindset, a frame of mind, and you can really go off in any direction. There is few countries in the world that don't have eggs as a almost like a national dish. There are lots of examples of that. But also, you cook an egg and you can reach into your larder or your cupboard and embellish it in thousands of ways and take it in those directions. So it was a little bit of a how do I refine this? But I tend to try to write useful cookbooks. And eggs are predisposed to being quite good for that because they're simple and I think everyone can cook them. But I also think that you're never going to cook every single recipe in a cookbook. So there are deliberately at least a third of those things in there are the kind of recipe or idea that I would reach that book, open it up and almost like Instagram, go, oh, right, yeah, I haven't thought about having paratha and chili oil with my egg today. Let's do that and close the book. And I don't mind that. Like, I don't need you to look at the instructions. So there are plenty of ideas in there that are literally there deliberately as a reminder. And a fried egg sandwich is as legitimate as a much more complicated, you know, kimchi and gochujang skillet eggs, which, you, again, the ingredients may well be in your cupboard, but you might not have thought of.
Are you a eggs for breakfast, lunch and dinner type of guy? And can you have eggs for breakfast, lunch and dinner?
Absolutely. I think probably most of the time the egg is probably before 12:30. It just tends to be the way I eat them. But I do think that eggs are the ultimate fast food. Like, I think people come home from work often and feel tired and want to throw something together quickly, and you know, one thing might be a pasta dish or a ready meal, but none of those things come together as quickly as an omelette or scrambled eggs or half the recipes in that book take less than 5 minutes. So yeah, any time of day meal is great. Can you eat them all day? I probably have done in the testing of this book.
How many eggs were cracked in the testing of this book?
God, too many. But there used to be an advert called Go to Work on an Egg, which was quite a big thing for the egg board in the sort of like the 70s. And it was extremely successful in making people think that you should have two eggs a day. It like literally made the sales in the UK equivalent to that. And then there was a belief that eggs were bad for dietary cholesterol, which has since been disproven, but continues, I think, in the mindset of people that if you have too many eggs, it's not good for you. That's actually incorrect, except that I think a lot of people probably do have quite a lot of butter and cheese.
Or it's on the egg itself.
Yeah, exactly. It's almost, and then you follow it with a cigarette and you're really screwing yourself over. But I also think that eggs are very filling. And apart from the egg paradox, where a three eggs in a scrambled egg or omelette doesn't feel like enough, but you'd never eat three boiled eggs in a row, I still think that breakfast, lunch, dinner might just be one egg too many.
I find it really funny that in the book you say everyone knows how to fry an egg. Mm. So I'm not going to teach you how to fry an egg. But I am going to teach you how to fry an egg. Yeah. So I suppose, what's the perfect way? But also, how much does it matter to perfect these basics so much? You know, like, I feel like, obviously, I look up recipes about lots of different things, and sometimes they're complicated. But one of the things that I look up the most on the internet is the timings for boiling eggs.
Okay.
Like, I just do that constantly. Yeah. I forget about it all the time, and I think it's a go-to for me. So how important is it to perfect the recipe?
So this is a two-part answer, which is the first answer, which goes to my first point you mentioned, is that it doesn't matter. Like, it's however you want to do it. I'm not going to tell you that you're wrong and I'm right. I have a preference for fried eggs, which is to start in a not a non-stick pan. So by that, I mean not a factory-enhanced non-stick, because I think that you get like a completely characterless egg out of that and they slip around and it freaks me out.
I get what you mean, though.
But whereas if you cook it on a carbon steel or a cast iron pan, which is nicely seasoned so it doesn't stick, but it also like creates character and like a bit of texture to that egg, I start it quite hot and then I turn it down and kind of control it. Fat in there is a little bit of oil and a lot of butter. But again, kind of helps to create flavour and texture. And I tend to finish it just as that white is set, but the yolk is not. But as I say, I think fried eggs are less important in terms of the style, because you can work it out in the pan. They're amazing, aren't you? Because you can look and see what's happening. It's the easiest and one of the most interesting things to cook, because you can literally see the egg cook and you can take it off or you can stop or you can start. But the boiled eggs ones is both really important to know how to do it. There's a very simple method, in my opinion.
That is?
The method is variable. the method is simple.
Like all simple methods.
Yeah, the method is simple in that the egg is at room temperature, not fridge temperature, because it takes a bit longer and you can't control it as easily. And it makes the water... Oh, this is making it complicated. It's not complicated. Boiling water, take it down to just below boiling or just above simmering, and drop room temperature eggs into that and start your timer. And then the second part is the variable, which is how long do you want it to run for, which in the book I've suggested there are kind of like four or five stages of boiled egg, from soft boiled that you're going to dip into and not peel, through to hard boiled that you might use in an egg mayo. In between ranges from 6.5 to about 8 minutes. And I've put different timings roughly as to what might be a runny yolk, a jammy yolk and a fudgy yolk. But ultimately, it then becomes up to you as to what you see as nice runny and what other people might see as, oh, that's a bit too runny or what's too hard. So I would say that you follow the general theme of just under boiling water, egg in, and set the timer. And there's some then timing points which you can trial. And then after that, you need to go, actually, I really like 6.5 minute eggs, or I really like 7.5 minute eggs, and stick to it, because it is pretty accurate if you know what you've done. I always look at people and they say, oh, I don't know how long I boil an egg for. I just put the timer on. Or just, you know, they turn over an egg timer, but no one can tell me how many minutes that is. So it's a pointless exercise.
It's a jump in the dark. But so, I find it really funny how people get really territorial about how they like, how runny they like their yolks, yeah, etc. People are really passionate about, yeah, eggs. And maybe it is because of that connection to childhood, as you say. I guess, what is the ultimate childhood egg memory for you?
Oh, good one. I it's very hard to not think of eggs in a cup holder and dipping some toast into it. I think that is actually the other childhood memory for me is my dad scrambling eggs badly in the microwave.
That was, oh God!
I think Dad, bless him, didn't do much of the cooking, but when he did, he really tried. But he used to do eggs in a microwave for, I've got three brothers, and what happens when you put eggs in a microwave and scramble them is that nothing happens, and then it's just like a set.
It's like popcorn. Firm,
and it becomes scrambled because you chop through it. So that is not a good memory. I suppose maybe at some point deciding that I wanted eggs in a different way and worked out how to perfect it myself on top of the stove, to my own opinion, and maybe that was the start of it.
You say something else that I think is very wise in the book, that is, you should never cook eggs for more than four people.
Exactly.
And I really believe that, because plenty of arguments were had in the kitchen for me, because I would make the eggs and the other person would eat them first. And by the time mine were ready, we were having two separate meals.
Yeah. So I tried to say now that, you know, fry an egg as you like, boil an egg as you like, your opinion. But my main rule is don't cook eggs for more than four people, because you, the cook, will not enjoy the egg at the same time. And the kitchen just becomes frantic. It's weirdly, for such a simple thing, it becomes a frantic experience. Obviously, there's a caveat to that, which is the whole chapter of eggs in which I suggest that you can have as group eggs, in which I've tried to sort of make, because ultimately, as a meal, it's so easy when you go away for the weekend with friends or have family over, you know, shall we have eggs in the morning? It's such an obvious thing to do as a brunch or breakfast idea. So I've got a bunch of ideas in there. But as you say, it's there's personal opinion. And most importantly of all, the cook so often gets the worst eggs. So it seems like a pretty raw deal.
You always have to serve yourself the worst egg, the one that you know is not going to run.
You know, it's like if you've done loads of fried eggs, or if you've decided to have a kind of a meal where everyone gets a fried egg, which means you're standing at the stove because you haven't got enough frying pans, inevitably you split one because it's a bad, you know, an old egg and it's slack or it sticks to the thing. And because you've cooked it, you feel obliged to have it. Or if you've overboiled or overpoached something, you have it. And that's, you know, I love cooking, but I also love eating, so I don't really see why I should get the worst egg.
Finally, I think it's very interesting that you really roam the world for the recipes in this book. There's Korean recipes, as you mentioned before, but also Nigerian, but also really from all around the world.
Yeah.
And as you say, it's interesting that almost every country will have some notable egg recipe.
Yeah.
But how do you see people eat eggs differently around the world? Is there a real difference? Because yes, the Scandi will have a fascination for really hard-boiled eggs that perhaps other people around the world be like, oh, that's a bit too much for me.
Sure.
How did you observe it? And have you travelled to these places to find out?
I mean, I probably have travelled to most of the places that I've got the ideas from and tried to, you know, not pass them off as my own. But I think generally it is the same core ingredient, which amazingly can be cooked in so many different ways. But the way that really changes is the spicing or the carb that you're having with it. Fried egg in Huevos Rancheros is just a fried egg with the Mexican accompaniments to it. And it just takes it immediately in a different direction to, again, having that toast and ketchup that your average Brit might have.
Ed Smith there in conversation with me at Midori House. Good Eggs is available in all good bookshops now. Next, we head to Athens. Here, like in most of the Mediterranean, people often use generous amounts of aromatic herbs such as thyme, oregano, and rosemary in their cooking. Many Athenians might even have a sunny spot on their balcony to grow their own, but for those who don't live next to a bustling southern European market, sourcing high-quality fresh herbs isn't always so simple. Greek native and former journalist Evangelia Koutsouvolou thought she could do something about bringing her home country's bounty to the rest of the world. Her brand, Daphne's and Chloe, bottles up the harvest from some of the nation's best producers so it can be shipped to keen cooks beyond Greece's borders. Monocle's Hester Underhill met with Evangelia at the company's base to find out more. She brings us this report.
The narrative of herbs has been a very big part for us since the beginning, since when we started. It was very important to be able to explain to people why these herbs are special, how they're sourced. When we started 10 years ago, the whole food movement barely existed. Much less people than today were interested into justifying like their expenditure into an artisanal product. So especially back then, it was hugely important to be able to explain to people that, look, you are used to something which is not the best version. It can be done in a completely different way. Mm-hmm. And we technically brought a product which one could potentially find when visiting an island or a remote place. And if by accident they met, you know, someone who makes these herbs, Or, you know, in some rare cases, you can have like a deli who has a direct contact, so they carry some nice oregano. But it was something quite unusual, you know,
quite
so
niche.
People quite niche.
And so when you launched the range, what were your core products?
Well, it was a very small venture, one person venture. So I thought that it was wiser to begin with four core products. You know, test them in the market and then see how to move forward. And these four core products were the oregano, of course, the thyme, the bay leaves, and the sage. And the choice was because they're very characteristic of the Greek terroir, probably the most used ones. And of course, later on, you know, going on, we expanded the range by a lot, little by little, more spices, then we brought in more herbal teas, and now we're somewhere around 25 products, I believe.
I was wondering how you find your producers as well. Do you go on a lot of research trips around the country looking for small producers to work with, or is that top secret?
Well, we find our producers in many, many different ways. Of course, we've been around for a decade, so by now we have a very solid database of pretty much everyone who makes herbs around Greece. But it can be a phrase that I like using, it is either the product will take you to the maker, or the maker will take you to the product. There have been occasions where we were looking for a specific thing, like with our smoked chili flakes, and we just went on and found every single person that cultivates smoked chili flakes, whether this is, you know, through formal entities like public entities or through universities because maybe they have sick advice, or through online catalogs, through word of mouth, calling the taverna, the little restaurant of the village, and asking if they know someone who makes the peppers, and many different, you have to get creative. But this is another thing which I guess I learned through my previous job. You know, when you write, you also learn how to make research.
Is that quite a satisfying part of the job?
Yeah, it is. It is very nice. It is very satisfying. And it is also nice because we've been around for a while, so we've witnessed this slight hopeful change where you have younger generations of people getting into herbs. When we started, it was mostly very old people, you know, who will eventually, you know, go on a pension, retire soon. So it's nice to see, you know, the new generation coming in, and it's also a very different way of thinking and doing things. Mm-hmm. So it's, you know, more connected. And the second thing that is very nice about this job is that you get to visit parts of the country that you would never ever see completely untouched. You have many places which are hard to reach, and this is a very important parameter for the herbs as well. It plays a huge role in biodiversity because we're a small country by square footage. It is small. But you have places which are completely different in terms of the sun exposure, the water, the vegetation, the wind that they get. And these are the elements that give to crops their character. The herbs especially, they get highly, hugely influenced by this. To give you another example, when you have an island with sea all around it, it is so difficult for seeds to travel, you know, with the air or with birds. So the plants that grow there cannot get so easily pollinated, you know, by other similar plants, which might influence their flavor and their, you know, further development. So the result is that you get very special, very unique varieties. And also, you know, the environment plays a very important role in different ways. Sage, for instance, is an herb which, and I'm talking, I might have to specify, I am talking about the Salvia pomifera, which is a variety that you can find in Greece, like around the Aegean, and not only, but the typically the variety that is typically encountered in Greece. Well, this type of sage changes a lot in strength and flavor depending on how arid the soil and the area is. The more deserted the land, the stronger the smell of sage.
It's more concentrated.
It is more concentrated, yeah. There is a village called Faskomilia, which is the Greek word for sage, for the sage plant. And their sage, it belongs to the same variety, but it has nothing to do with the one from Crete, for instance. It has a completely different flavor. And the best comparison that I can think of is wine. You can get let's say an Assyrtiko that is made in Santorini and then an Assyrtiko that is made up in northern Greece and another one made in another part of the world, and they will be three different wines.
Thanks, Hester. You're listening to The Menu. Now it's time for the week's top food and drink headlines. Here is Monocle's Monica Lillis.
Winemakers in the Bordeaux region of France have expressed their anger over the French retail giant Carrefour selling wine at prices cheaper than water. The low costs for the bottles came as a result of a supermarket bulk deal, with some stores selling 6 bottles of AOP Comte de Magnac for €9.96, working out at €1.66 per bottle. Gironde and Nouvelle Aquitaine winemakers protested that this move meant their industry was being ransacked by super low commercial prices. The James Beard Foundation announced the finalists for this year's Restaurant and Chef Awards this week in Washington, D.C. Nominations went to Dakar Nola, a Senegalese restaurant in New Orleans, and Gregory Gourdet of Portland-based Haitian restaurant Cannes, among others. Winners of the awards will be announced in mid-June at a ceremony at the Lyric Opera in Chicago. And finally, China's Ministry of Commerce announced that it will lift tariffs on Australian wines for 3 years, signalling an end to a challenging era for the industry. China was once the biggest buyer of Australian wine, accounting for 40% of exports, but punitive barriers meant that the trade between the two nations had slipped dramatically. However, the decision to remove the tariffs comes just under a year after Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese announced Australia and China had agreed on a pathway to improve the two nations' relationship. Those are the week's food and drink headlines. Now back to Chiara.
Thanks, Monica. You're listening to The Menu. Making a career as a chef may take you around the world, training in Michelin-starred kitchens, but when it comes to opening your own venture, it's important to follow your inclinations and cook the kind of food that speaks to you on both a personal and creative level. Finnish chef Kim Mikkola cut his teeth at some of the best fine dining restaurants in Scandinavia and spent time at Noma, but he eventually set his sights on achieving an altogether different culinary dream, making the best chicken slider there is. That's why, alongside his Michelin-starred restaurant Inari in Helsinki, Mikkola opened up his chicken burger eatery, Kot. In the business's various outposts across Tallinn, he makes tasty burgers with premium ingredients that still cost less than many big chains. Mikkola believes that delicious food and indulgent experiences belong to everyone, not just those who frequent fine dining restaurants. Our correspondent Petri Burtsov headed to Kot in Tallinn to learn more.
With hip-hop blasting on the speakers, Kim Mikkola is prepping the staff at Kot Noblesner just before lunchtime. Mikkola is a Noma-trained and Michelin-starred chef, but this restaurant, located in a former submarine shipyard in Tallinn, is about as far as one can imagine from the fine dining world of white tablecloths. On the menu are Mikkola's take on chicken burgers. Crispy, high-quality fried chicken served in a style that Mikkola himself characterizes as Korea meets Nashville. We've seen Michelin-starred chefs take on burgers before, but not in this style. So the obvious question to ask Mikkola was, why chicken?
So when I was in Noma, I always kind of joked around that I'm going to have one day a chicken shop. And then suddenly, COVID hit, restaurants got closed. You know, we closed our Michelin-star restaurant, or everything had to be closed, mandatory. So we're like, why not? you know, let's just like, let's try this chicken thing. And just turned out from the day one, or even trying when it didn't have any names or whatever, was sold out like in 3 minutes was the first one. We did like 50 sandwiches. And it was like 3 minutes. The next day was 7 minutes. I was like, okay. I was like, maybe there is something there. I mean, I love fried chicken. It's like one of those things. Like first time was in the U.S. I was like, well, what is this? I mean, it's not necessarily like a Finnish, you know, national dish. It's not fried chicken. So first time I had it in the U.S. and then I went to Korea, I was like, whoa. Like, whoa. Japan, whoa. So it's like, it is an interesting thing. And I think it's like, has like a combination of everything that most people like. Crispy, juicy, chicken is good. So yeah, spicy.
For Mikkola, one of the key priorities was to keep the prices affordable. In fact, his burgers cost just between 4 to 8 euros, making them in most cases cheaper than McDonald's. During the pandemic, while still living in his native Helsinki, Mikkola made home-cooked, high-quality meals that people could pick up for 5 euros. He likens his food philosophy to IKEA, a company that believes that beautiful homes belong to everyone.
Obviously, my background, the training that I have is like very avant-garde and classic and Michelin and like fine dining. For example, just in Noma, we speak about a lot about ideas and impact and what we can do. And that's something that stayed with me, like that idea of impact. And then when I was doing Inari, like we impacted Helsinki in a way that, you know, we changed some things there and we gave like some ideas. But then I started thinking around the COVID time is that, you know, if I really, really want to impact people, I have to start thinking like IKEA. IKEA's like phrase is like beautiful homes belong to everybody. So why don't delicious food belong to everybody or luxurious experiences belong to everybody? So that's when we started doing that shift. And yeah, I was just basically going through the target group. It's like if I sell a menu for 200 euros, the target group is very small. But if I sell something for like a fiver, like under a fiver, I mean, the target group is almost everybody who has a fiver, so, or eats chicken, you know? So it's a bit bigger group that I can impact.
So what's next for Mikkola? He moved to Tallinn a year ago, attracted by what he calls the incredible energy in the city's up-and-coming food scene. He started by running a Japanese izakaya pop-up Kanpai, but is now fully concentrated on expanding his chicken burger venture.
Got this like very, it's a very dear project for me. And obviously we're shooting out to have a couple of more locations in Tallinn. We should have 3 at least by the end of this year, just in Tallinn. And I don't know what else there is in the horizon, but I really, really hope that if there is anything that I could help Tallinn achieve in the kind of restaurant and culinary industry, like I have some kind of ideas and some kind of background that I can look back to and just give out some pointers and tips and see if I can do something cool.
Mikkola is keen to leave his mark on Tallinn's vibrant food scene, but his future aspirations go further than that.
At this point of life, what I want to do is I want to learn about how to run these big operations that, you know, have an impact for as many people as possible. But I would like to go from there to, you know, go to the dark side, like go to the government kind of side and just trying to help out there, because I feel like there's a lot of stuff that we could do within the food industry that could change how people like experience food on a day-to-day basis. So like for me, this journey has been like to understand the craft, to understand the highest peak of gastronomy, then, you know, trying to recreate it myself with somewhat okay results.
For Monocle in Tallinn, I'm Petri Burtsov.
Petri Burtsov there. And that's all for this edition of The Menu. Remember that we are back with a new episode again on Friday at 20:00 London time. That's at midday in San Francisco. Also, don't forget to tune into our spin-off show Food Neighborhoods for a tour of some of the world's tastiest destinations. I am Chiara Rimella. This program was produced by Monica Lillis, and our sound engineers were Mariella Bevan, Lily Austin, and Tamsin Howard. Thanks for listening, and until next week.